The Adventures of Elizabeth Crown presents The Woman in the Sky, Episode 3. Elizabeth watched the equations emerge, a perplexing line of digits and letters. The chalk scratched its way across the blackboard, and Elizabeth struggled to transcribe what she saw. But as cross-eyed as the formulae made her, Elizabeth was also distracted. She watched the tightly wrapped bun on top of her professor's head. She watched the shoulders shake with every jot of the chalk. She traced the voluptuous curve of Ms. Grayson's back, the slight swish of her black dress. As she wrote, her second arm was akimbo against her hip, like a flamenco dancer. Could she really be a murderer? Elizabeth felt a pressure in her forehead, an intense sensation, but not unpleasant. As she pondered her professor, Elizabeth absently twisted strands of her hair around her idle pencil. Yes, Ms. Grayson had a penetrating presence. Her eyes were fierce, her mouth was mocking. Even her dark dresses were severely fashioned. But she did not seem cruel. She had never degraded her students, never insulted their intelligence. In truth, she was captivating. She lashed out questions like the crack of a whip. She strode about the room in figure eights, tantalizing the young men with her incandescence. If Ms. Grayson was a cold-blooded murderess, then anyone could be. Suddenly, she twirled around. The students leaned back, surprised by her movement. Ms. Grayson studied them, then slapped the chalk on her table. "Why do we do this?" she purred. She brushed a finger across her lips as she inspected the room. Why do we do what?" someone cheeped. "Why chemistry? Why study these strings of numbers?" The only sound was a gust of wind rattling the window sills. Ms. Grayson turned her head to the board, then reached out and touched the chalk markings with the tips of her fingers. "I find them beautiful." "Perhaps you think that odd. How could numbers be beautiful? Look at this one, a delta, just a little triangle." She gazed at them tenderly. "What you see up here is life. Nitrogen and oxygen combine to make the air you breathe. Hydrogen and oxygen make the water you drink. Oxygen and carbon make us." She turned halfway, eyeing her students, petrifying them in their seats. "These numbers are you, your body, your blood. Your thoughts are chemistry. Your soul is chemistry. These exchanges make you what you are." Ms. Grayson folded her arms and moved toward the rattling window. Tree branches swayed in the gathering wind, and specks of snow raced past the rectangular glass. "Remember that," she said. "Dull as they may seem, these numbers are the shorthand of your existence. You have but one life. Understanding what you are is the greatest gift there is." She sniffed, rubbed her upper arm, and said, "I think that's enough for today." "Do we have an assignment?" squeaked a voice. "Yes," said Ms. Grayson. "If the snow sticks, I want you to build a snowman." The students traded glances. Then they allowed themselves to chuckle. They clapped their books shut, gathered their coats and bags, and filed out of the room. Elizabeth felt queasy. She slid away from her desk and collected her things. But before she could reach the door, she heard Ms. Grayson speak. "Miss Crown, a moment of your time." Slowly, Elizabeth turned back to her professor. Ms. Grayson still faced the window, but Elizabeth could see her own reflection in the glass, an opaque outline, a profile lacking any definition, small compared to Ms. Grayson's daunting figure. Elizabeth swelled with shame and fear. What was she even doing? Had she really agreed to spy on her professor? To catalog her movements? All because of a cockamamie accusation told to her in private by a biologist she barely knew? When the room had fully emptied, Ms. Grayson said, "I met your father once." "Oh?" "At a symposium. He was lecturing on physics. You're probably tired of hearing how brilliant he is." Elizabeth cradled her books tighter. "He's also a good man," Ms. Grayson went on. She turned slightly and leaned a shoulder against the windowsill, still watching the falling snow. The thick flakes now fell in earnest. "You and I have something in common. We were raised by decent fathers." She tapped her fingertips together, as if uncertain how to continue. "I wouldn't blame you for being anxious." Elizabeth was startled. "How do you mean?" "Before me," Grayson said, "there were three women who taught among these halls. One taught algebra. Another taught nutrition. The third taught how to dress wounds. She had served as a nurse during the Civil War. She was old and feisty, and she could break a wild stallion if she wanted to. I admired her the most, but I respected them all. This is a school full of men. Men who like to play God. They have no patience for women." She shot a glance at Elizabeth. "Yet you are here. The first. As a student, you have no predecessors. No one knows what to make of you. You're too bright to bully. You're too headstrong to woo. What is a young man to do with you? So, they do nothing. They ignore you. They pretend you don't exist." "Not all of them," Elizabeth mumbled. "You must mean Abner Cohen," scoffed Ms. Grayson. "A Jew with a basketball scholarship. They're a dime a dozen. Or a dime for two dozen if they get their way. But you are different, and will always be. I know this, because we have something in common." Elizabeth sighed heavily. "I know what you're saying. We're unafraid of truth." Ms. Grayson pulled herself away from the window and went to the table to arrange her scattered papers. 100,000 housewives would drink that radiated water, just because some salesman told them to. 100,000 more would lobotomize their children, or coat themselves in snake oil, or swallow a handful of sugar pills. But you would not. Ms. Grayson bundled the papers together and strode toward the door. Then she stopped and said over her shoulder, "I didn't want you here. I even told the Chancellor. I thought it was nepotism. Dr. Crown's daughter, I thought. Of course they'd let her in. But that wasn't it at all. I see that now. And I'm glad to have been so wrong." And then Ms. Grayson quit the room, leaving Elizabeth alone. Elizabeth pressed her palms against her face, squishing her cheeks together. Her elbows rested on the study Carol's flat surface. Her eyes stared blankly at the text beneath her. But Elizabeth wasn't reading it. She was lost in thought, having long forgotten that she was in a school library, in the loneliest corner, besieged by stacks of reference books. "Elizabeth!" someone hissed. She jolted upright, alarmed by her own name, and then she scowled. "Abner, what are you doing here?" "We have to talk," he whispered. He breathed heavily, and his cheeks were flushed. He had clearly run here, but he was also a mess. He had buttoned his coat in the wrong holes, and his hat lay askew over disheveled hair. "Fine, said Elizabeth, crossing her arms. May I sit down? Go, sit. It's not my library. Abner dragged a chair from a nearby table and placed it next to Elizabeth. She found this awkward and angled her own chair sideways so they could sit face to face. They leaned toward each other and spoke in hushed voices. So, what is it? I was just at practice, began Abner. We finished, and I went to the showers. The boys were talking, and one of them... Do you know Riley?
The scrawny red-haired boy?
That's him. Anyway, he said he'd seen something. The other night, he stepped out for a cigarette. He wanted to see the moon, which was almost full. Do you remember?
Yes, yes. So what happened?
Well, he was standing near the dining hall, but on the north side, closer to the woods. And when he looked up, he saw something in the sky.
What kind of something?
He said he saw a woman.
A what?
I know, it sounds crazy. The other boys made fun of him, but Riley, he couldn't stop himself. He's such an earnest kid. He said he saw the shape of a woman flying through the sky. And it was a clear night. The moon was so bright. He said he saw her clearly.
Abner faltered. He shook his head at the floor, then removed his hat and wiped his brow with the back of his hand. As he did this, a memory flickered in Elizabeth's mind, and she pointed a finger at Abner.
You saw the same thing, didn't you? She said.
When Abner didn't respond, she went on.
That's why you asked me about large birds. You saw a woman in the sky, and you thought you were seeing things.
It was the same night, Abner murmured. I was in my room. My window faces north, just where Riley saw.
Abner covered his face in his hands.
I just think, if I've lost my mind, Riley must have too.
A woman in the sky, Elizabeth said to herself. Abner, you've been here longer than I have. Do you know where Miss Grayson lives? Does she live on campus?
Miss Grayson? I don't think so.
Abner looked flummoxed, but then he raised his eyebrows. Wait, she lives on Dayton Road. I forget why I know that, but one of the other boys was joking about it because her name rhymes, Miss Grayson of Dayton.
Elizabeth reached forward and squeezed Abner's arm.
Thank you for telling me this. Suffice it to say, you're not crazy. Neither is Riley. But let's keep this between us, all right?
But what is it? Abner pleaded. Does it have something to do with, you know, that meeting you had?
Let's talk about it later, interrupted Elizabeth. Right now, I need to find a bicycle.
Abner raised an eyebrow inquisitively and said, What if I could find two?
Henrietta could not decide whether to eat her apple. She was peckish, yes, but this apple was such a robust red sphere. It fit her long fingers so snugly. She leaned into the spokes of her swivel chair and studied its perfect shape, the unnatural gleam of its skin in the subdued morning light. One bite would ruin that smooth pelt, exposing the white flesh within, which would stain itself brown in a matter of minutes. How unjust it was! She looked beyond the apple at the papers scattered across her desk. She sighed at the jumble of numbers and Cartesian graphs, the half-understood axes of ambivalent mathematicians. Above her desk, the window panes were sweaty with moisture, obscuring her view of the campus's central court. The grayness of the day made the rooftops and foothills seem to blend together, mimicking the algebraic curves of all that ungraded homework. Such a grisly day, she thought. I should be home now. No one should have to leave her living room when the weather's like this. A tapping at her door roused Henrietta from her reverie. She sat up straight and rotated toward the entrance. In the doorway stood two figures,
The first was a man, medium-sized and mustached, with tiny round spectacles. He self-consciously withdrew a feathered Homburg from his head, revealing thin and graying hair. His other hand was pressed against the shoulder of a boy.
"How may I help you, gentlemen?" said Henrietta. Yet she directed the question not at the man, but the boy. He was small and rosy-cheeked, and his tight-fitting trousers betrayed the skinniness of his legs. The rest of him was covered in a bulky brown coat and loosely tied scarf. His face was barely visible beneath the brim of an oversized deerstalker.
"Forgive us, miss," stuttered the man. "I'm a little turned around. Do you know where to find the office of Dr. Jensen?"
Henrietta felt a quiver beneath her left eye, as if a pill bug were trapped in that pillow of skin and was struggling to escape. She felt heat burning through her body, like the rekindled coals of a campfire. She gazed at the boy, his little patch of face framed in layers of wool.
"And what's your name?" Henrietta murmured to the boy.
The man straightened his shoulders impatiently. He said,
"Answer the lady's question, Archie."
The boy's eyes dropped to the tiles.
"Archibald Wakefield, ma'am."
"And how old are you?"
"Miss, I apologize," said the man hurriedly, "but we're a bit pressed for time."
Henrietta felt her pulse everywhere, in her wrists, in her neck, her Achilles, and most of all, pounding in her chest. She felt the air escaping briskly through her nostrils. When she swallowed, she heard her throat crackle. Even her tongue dragged tensely across the roof of her mouth.
"You're a very handsome boy, Archie," said Henrietta. "I'd adore to have a child like you."
And then, just as the man opened his mouth to speak, Henrietta turned to him and said,
"One flight down, room 212. It's the only green door. You shan't miss it."
The man clapped his jaw shut and flushed with relief. He grimaced and bowed his chin, then pulled Archie away from the doorway.
"Much obliged, miss,"
Henrietta said. "Professor." The man paused in mid-step.
"I'm sorry?"
"I am a professor of chemistry and higher maths," said Henrietta bluntly.
The man adjusted his spectacles, then forced himself to grin.
"Ah, well then, good day."
The two figures vanished, leaving the doorframe empty. Henrietta reached to her desk and grasped a pencil. She held it in the air, then twirled it around in her fingers. Her eyes burned. For a moment, she wondered whether she could suppress the wave of emotion. But it was coming. She could feel it. The walls of her office seemed to warp inward. The ceiling weighed down. The fury. That familiar fire in her belly, it coursed inside her. She took deep drafts of air. She tried to concentrate on the desk, the walls, her small bookcase packed with volumes, but they melted away. The fury consumed everything. It rendered all tangible things invisible. And soon her eyes welled up with memory. She remembered the cell. She could picture herself there, even now, all these years later. The thin straw mattress, the plain wood cross nailed to the stone wall, the tiny window that shed so little light, even at midday, the curdled stench of the chamber pot stashed beneath her bunk and shared with a dozen other girls, the cold that seeped through her ragged nightgown, her fingers coiled with the memory of that scrub brush, her back still felt the relentless ache of bent-over toil. Absently, she touched her hair, dug through its brown thickness, and massaged her scalp. Henrietta could still feel where her hair had been yanked when the sisters had dragged her across the floor. she could still sense the tingle of saliva on her cheeks where the sisters had spat on her. She could still wince the way she had always winced at the slurs the sisters had flung at her. Henrietta looked at her hand. She groped the pencil tight. Her knuckles trembled, and her blue veins were strained beneath the ivory skin. The graphite point faced downward. She held the implement like a dagger. "It's happening again," she thought. Or perhaps she whispered it aloud, she couldn't tell. She was entranced, just like all those times before. The fury took hold of her, and it wouldn't let go. It demanded action. It demanded blood. She pictured herself rising from this chair, floating through the door, and stalking down the hall. She would follow the man in the Homburg hat. She imagined raising that pencil above him. Yet it would not be she who brandished the pencil, but the fury. The same fury that the sisters had cultivated all those months. The fury they had sown and harvested with every thwack of their paddles. They had ripped away her womanhood and replaced it with the fury. And that is why she would wait until the man turned round, curious, surprised to see Henrietta behind him. His eyes would bulge with disbelief, but too late. Henrietta would drive the pencil down into his impotent body. The fury would slash through him, and Henrietta would watch, disembodied, as the man crumpled to her feet. "I can't stay here," she thought. Henrietta slammed the pencil to her desk. She rose and adjusted her blouse, then tore her coat from its peg. Suddenly, Henrietta heard the clang of a bell. The noise jostled her, and she leaned against the bookcase. She glanced out the window and identified its source. The church bell clanged from its steeple, just as it did every hour. Her eyes traced the shape of the chapel, dropping down the slate roof, the open doorway, and the stone steps. She saw the lawn, its grass a patchwork of pale green and patches of mud. Then she saw it, a buggy. The delicate vehicle was parked in the middle of the yard, its seat covered in a black canopy. Beside it stood a gray-bearded man, wearing a thick duster and a broad hat. He patted the faces of the buggy's two horses, then waved to passers-by. "Dr. Ridge," she thought. "He'll be out making house calls. He'll give me a ride. He'll take me home. He'll save me from the fury." Ms. Grayson stormed out of her office, not stopping to even shut the door. You've been listening to The Woman in the Sky. The Adventures of Elizabeth Crown is produced by Backpack Media, LLC. For more information about Elizabeth Crown and the exciting field of uncanology, visit elizabethcrown.net. Special thanks to Naoya Sakamata for the use of her music.